Welcome to the Fangled Cast, brought to you by Fangled Technologies, where we help you convert every person your company touches into a voracious advocate for your brand.
And hello, we're back with another episode of the Fangled Cast. Today's going to be kind of fun because I get to hang out with a guy that I recently met who I've got great respect for. His name is Tim Kubiak. And rather than me screw up his bio, Tim, say hello to the audience and let them know who you are and what the heck you do.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. So Tim Kubiak, and I work with founders, sales organizations, and high-performing individuals. And it's really about creating businesses go-to-market and driving results.
And today's topic is founders. And what is a founder? What do they need? And how do you work with them? So how about we start with you telling us a little bit about your relationship with founders, and we can kind of go from there.
So I think you have to start by putting them in buckets to begin with, right? So are they a founder that has an idea, maybe has some bootstrap money or even some seed money, and they're trying to get it to market? Have they developed a minimum viable product? Because those are two different creatures in and of themselves.
Sure.
Versus a founder that has a mature business or a thriving business that either has to evolve or they're getting ready to exit. So if you look, I work with people across all four of those sets, if you will, but the three main buckets are: I have a dream, I might have a product, and I have a business.
And typically, in what areas are the founders that you seek to work with? Are they IT guys? Are they fixed product, service?
So there is a bit of service. There's an increasing amount of people in the SaaS space, right? Everything's become SaaS in the last year, and it was going that way for, you know, 3 years prior. Certainly around IT security, things of that nature, because that's a bit of my pedigree, my history. So I've worked with people in telecom and in other software applications as well.
So you like founders that are a little sassy?
I like sassy founders, absolutely.
You know, it's so funny. These terms that are out, like SaaS, I've had it happen where I'm talking about SaaS and someone goes, what's wrong with sassy people? And the other one that's hilarious, it was a client of mine it couldn't understand why the people in Finland are coming out with so much tech. He thought fintech meant that it was coming from Finland, not that it was finance.
Oh, not financial tech.
And of course, you know, how do you address with somebody something that big without, you know, being kind, but not embarrassing them that they've been saying that for months. It's like a guy who's walked around all day with his fly open and you're the one to tell him, you know, so
you could have gone to the DeFi conversation.
Yeah. Anyhow, let's get back on topic here because the host is now off topic. So when you meet with a founder, let's go bucket by bucket. A guy comes to you and really doesn't have anything yet. What does that conversation sound like?
So it's really interesting because a lot of times they're trying to solve a problem that they've created, right? And they haven't done the market research. And my joke is nobody ever hires me because things are going perfectly. Mm-hmm. People hire me when there's a problem. So I come in, I sit down, I look at what the idea is. And I'm not a market analyst guy, though I will make dozens and dozens and dozens of calls to go say, okay, look, I'm working with someone who's thinking about this thing. Mm-hmm. And so part of it is really level setting what they want to be, because a lot of times they're trying to be too many things, and also who might want to buy it.
Gotcha. So really that person is someone who believes that they have defined a problem that they think they can solve.
Yeah. Or they've written a widget that's an add-on piece of software to something that exists and they think the world needs it. Yeah.
And when you get someone in at that level, do you challenge whether or not the problem they're solving is a problem either that exists and people know about it, exists but people aren't aware, or is only in your head?
Yeah, you do. And that's where, you know, frankly, I joke, I start everything with a 30 to 90 day contract. Mm-hmm. Right? And people will say, no, I want to do a year. You don't, because you don't know if you really like me yet. Mm-hmm. Right. And the truth is, my job is to come in and be honest.
From our marketing perspective, we always look at those three areas because so many times people come to us with a project where they have solved a problem that does not exist anywhere. I posted something a while ago about a company that created an easy to open turkey bag. And I laughed about it when I saw it because the one place that every person has a knife is the location where you're going to open up the bag that the turkey came in, your kitchen.
That's right.
So who whose problem are they solving? And if you're solving that problem, does anyone even know that it is? And if you're a consumer in a supermarket and you see two turkeys and one of them has an easy open bag and the other one doesn't, is that what moves the needle to get you to buy that turkey? Is it, you know, is it something that matters? So that's interesting that you encounter that with all of that bucket of founders.
So you do. I don't know about you, but I also run into people that aren't realistic about what people will pay for it.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, is it a problem that I want solved? And if so, am I willing to pay for it? That's a key. So tell me the next bucket. What does that conversation sound like?
So the next bucket, especially in the tech world, is they've got an idea. They mm-hmm. kind of know who their market is, and they need to get to a minimum viable product.
Okay.
Right. So in many cases, it's a wireframe. In some cases, they actually do a build that they can do in an alpha test. It's not even really a beta at that point. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting time to be involved with founders and companies, because the peaks and valleys are massive. Right. And I have the advantage that it's not my dream. It's my job to try and help that dream come true or determine whether it can't. Mm-hmm. So I don't get as much emotional swing, but literally it's like, so-and-so asked me for this feature set. That's great. That's one conversation out of 1,000. Mm-hmm. Are they going to pay to dev it? So there's a lot of reality setting, and it's a strange thing for the guy leading the go-to-market to have to do that. But the engineering and the product dev teams, and often the visionary, need somebody that kind of plays lukewarm water and says, do we need to boil it or do we need to make ice cubes?
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting as you kind of think about that, because now you've got a guy who's got a problem defined, has a solution for it, but really is lacking scale.
Yeah.
Is it a big enough problem that it could be a profitable thing if I sold to the entire possible market who could use that solution? Is it profitable?
Yeah.
Do I have a solution that somehow bests other alternative solutions to the same problem? Those are all the conversations that you have at that point.
They are. And the other thing is you have to assess, and frankly, I try to do it even going into the project, mm-hmm. the founder's technical skill set.
Okay.
Right. Can they write code? Do they understand the functions of what they're proposing to solve? Or is it a theoretical?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a huge gap and there's a huge difference in what you go through in dev and route to market. Because if you have somebody who has that visionary idea, but has zero technical aptitude beyond the conversational level, it's a much, much longer road.
So in a case like that, though, would your alternative be to see if there's a way to build a team around it?
It is. And that's where it really comes down to the funding, right? And I know you and I both help people get to the point where they're ready for investors and other people's money.
Sure.
And that's one of the things that you have to do, and you probably run into it yourself. People who have not done this, that have not raised outside money, everybody thinks that angel investors are on every corner just waiting to throw money out. Yeah, it's easy. Everybody does it.
Just bring a jar with pencils and sell them a couple.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if you did your slides and you put some crayon on them, big deal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, so some of it's preparing them for that reality, and also preparing them for the reality that maybe the team of founders, maybe there's 4 or 6 people that were there at the inception before, you know, someone like me came along, and saying, you know, if you get money from X, Y, or Z, they're going to put in their own board. You might still be CEO, but you're not going to have controlling interest because of the amount of money you need to raise.
Sure.
And a lot of that goes into that conversation, right? And everybody thinks, I love everybody comes to me with an exit plan. I'm going to do this. It's going to be as big as Facebook, and I'll be out in 18 to 36 months.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great. In that case, my fees went up 4 times.
I have the same strategy for lottery tickets.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. It is incredible. The one that I hear the most when I'm dealing with business applications is, this thing is so good, I know Salesforce is going to buy it as soon as we become successful. So that's my exit. And
I am one of
those. And I it's almost like these people go to sleep at night and they have this dream of this thing called Salesforce in the cloud, just throwing money at them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you kind of have to be really darn good and successful before something like that, unless you just fell off the lucky train.
Yeah. You know, so I've got a friend who's a CEO in a different segment of the tech industry now, but he was at a company, got acquired by a large security company, and he was brought in. It was probably 5 to 7 years old when he was brought in. It was, you know, 20 some million dollars in revenue. They had a product that people needed. They had legitimate competitors. They could never reach scale as an independent company. Mm-hmm. So essentially they got sold during a board meeting on, I won't say it was an unsolicited bid, but it was pretty darn close, mm-hmm. right? And it was, do we do this and risk not being in business in the next 6 months, or do we sell off to Goliath?
Yep.
But it wasn't the multiple everybody dreams of. And that's the other reality that I think founders don't always understand, right? I might've built this, my EBITDA might be X or Y, but they're not getting the $100 million they dreamed of, even if they get bought out and do have cash flow.
Nor 99.9 million, yeah.
Yeah, no, not even close.
Yeah. So let's move on to that last bucket. Now you've got a founder who has an idea, has a viable product ready to go. How do those conversations begin?
So it's interesting. It's always it's a mix of what you do and what I do, quite frankly, mm-hmm. right? Because the first thing I always want to do is talk to them about their marketing plan, what their customer avatar looks like, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. They're like, yeah, but we're bringing you in to run sales. That's great. Marketing is a different animal, right? So it's setting some of that expectations. There are cases where they've had agencies and other things that I've helped with. And I certainly helped dial in the messaging and the presentation stuff, you know, from a customer facing perspective, but setting that reality. And then I'm a math guy, and I know the world can't be solved by algorithms, and I teach against it. But the truth is, sometimes math works. If you need X customers, you need Y prospects, and you need Z to raise their hand, and your conversion rate is 20%, or if you're new in the block, 13 to 15% best case scenario, if you've gotten to this point, and you start to run that math, and then I actually back into what the sales org has to look like based on hours. Right. So it's these type of conversations we expect, you know, are they just going to sign it as a click wrapper? You know, are they going to pay by credit card? Is it going to require a purchase order? All of those things, sure. And structure the sales org around that with them. And it literally their eyeballs will pop out of their head. What do you mean we need 7 people to get 4 million customers?
Yeah. And it's funny too, because for me, you're already jumping the gun into that whole sales mathematics when the marketing team hasn't even really figured out yet. What is the value proposition of what they're doing? How are they solving a problem in a way that all of the alternatives can't beat them?
Yeah.
And I rarely talk about the competitors anymore. I talk about alternatives to the solution, because when you think competitor, you think people that are doing what you're doing. You know, it's like, you know, what are the competition for CRM? Well, one of the competitors for CRM is a legal pad and a pen.
Yeah.
That is a competitor to CRM. It's a choice. Yeah. Excel is a direct alternative or competitor, if you want to call it, Excel to an ERP.
Yeah.
So when you're having those discussions with the customer from the marketing perspective, really digging into what is it that you can solve better than anybody else, and the people who you're solving, can they afford what it's going to cost for you to do it?
Yeah.
And then you can kind of jump into that sales strategy, which feeds from what you learn from the marketing. And also, you know, doing the prospecting, getting in touch with and figuring out who are those customers, where are they, how are their decisions made, and how do I get their money?
And that buying cycle, the customer journey and buying cycle conversation, the first time you have it with somebody who's never done it before, can be a lot of fun.
It is. It's fun when you see kind of the light bulb start to appear, and sometimes it's on and sometimes it's not, but you see the light bulb.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process, because that, you know, so many times, and this is the part that becomes for me a challenge sometimes with people, because you have to be bold, you have to be kind, but you also have to be completely transparent and truthful. So to say, for example, I remember there was a company that a designer who had invented a way of making micro copper wire in Israel. I met him through a contact and he wanted to go to market. And the way micro copper wire is done is through a pulling process. He figured out a way to put it through a specific type of a die that he created that eliminates literally millions of dollars of equipment to make it happen. But he was impossible to take to market because he thought he was the marketing guy. He thought he was the sales guy. He was a non-communicative, angry engineer with a brilliant, brilliant invention that could change the world with absolutely no ability to take that to market unless he sold it as a licensed product and let someone else run with it because he just couldn't do it. So I'm, you know, in the IT space, I always joke, when I'm dealing with really, really good coders who are completely introverted inside their head, can we pitch without you in the meeting? Mm-hmm. Or if we bring you into the meeting, can you only be there if technical questions come up? Because we're going to bring someone else in who knows how to pitch. How often do you have to have those conversations with these guys that you have a brilliant business, but you're not the guy to be pitching it?
You know, 8 out of 10 times.
8 out of 10. How do you handle that?
Frankly, you tell it to them straight. Look, you know, this is your audience. Sometimes it's getting them to identify their own passion. My passion is the product development. My passion is doing X and Y. Okay, great. You got a good finance team. You've got a good marketing team, right? You know, arguably you have a decent sales leader here. Let us run through that. And you can do the broad brushstrokes, welcome and vision. And, you know, you can close it out and play nerd in the middle. And there's a friend of mine that's started a company and he's Israeli as well, ironically. And he knows that weakness. He's absolutely brilliant, but he is technically minded. So he will open something and he will close something and lend that gravitas of that expertise there. But he lets his team run everything in the middle and mm-hmm. he's built a great company because of it.
Yep. You know, it's funny, even in the pool of freelancers that we use at Fangled for projects that we build teams around, I've got a few guys in that team that I would never introduce to a client. Yeah. Ever.
Yeah.
Man, are they good at what they do. Yeah. They're, you know, and it's my job to manage the lunacy to get to the end product. So, you know, a lot of times with new businesses and founders, I haven't done much in that IT space. Most of mine are in actual physical products and manufacturing. Yeah. I've come across it a lot of times, and those conversations can be a little uncomfortable, but it's tough love, and it usually, if done properly, really benefits the organization.
It is, right? And frankly, the beauty of being in roles like we play is if it's not a fit and it's not going well, you simply say, look, guys, here's what I think. Obviously, you're going a different direction. Let's just, you know, wind this down. I'm giving you my 45 days notice on my contract and we'll part as friends. I'll help you find a replacement.
Yeah. And we all have different personality types. And typically the personality type of the brilliant inventor is somewhat askew from the perfect CEO, the perfect finance guy, the perfect marketer. There's a great book that I always recommend called What Got You Here Won't Get You There.
I have it. I love that book.
Goldman's one of my heroes, but well, the thing that's so interesting about that in dealing with founders, and I don't think that I've ever worked with a founder that I didn't recommend that book to, because for me, it was life-changing. When I went from being the absolute hunter salesman, turning over every rock, getting in the door, all of the aggression in terms of action and mindset to be a hunter salesman made me the worst sales manager in the world. Until I read that book and recognized that the skill set that made me so good at that needed to be put aside to gain a whole new skill set and being able to coach and mentor and grow salespeople. The hunter salesman's idea of a sales coaching process is, dude, you don't know what you're doing. Let me show you. And step over the salesman and go, rather than encourage and listen and help, you know, motivate. So I would imagine that for your founders, when you come across those difficult situations, helping them change that mindset's got to be a powerful tool for you.
Yeah, it is. And helping them even recognize their own strengths beyond their vision. You know, to your point, the brilliant introverted coder, you know, and somebody told me a story years ago and it always stuck with me. You can have the most brilliant Wall Street financier, MBA from Ivy Leagues, et cetera. If you take him to a wedding and ask him to dance and he can't dance, he'll be uncomfortable. You shouldn't do that in business either, right? Let people do what they're good at, right? There's a reason I don't do finance. There's a reason I don't really do marketing. It's not what I do well, right? Know your lane, stick to it, understand other parts of the business, certainly, but do what you're best at.
Yep. Yeah, it's very important. So tell me, as we're sort of going through this process, so you've had this initial coaching session, who else do you bring into these meetings or on board to help take that company to the next level? Do you have resources outside of your great sales skills and coaching skills?
So I do. So I have a couple of people I work with that actually are operational in nature, logistical based in nature, because even with software products, you have to deal with license keys and renewals and triggers. I do have some coders and developers I turn to from time to time to look at things from a business prospect, revenue prospect piece. And ironically, we talked about CRMs earlier. Part of what I end up doing is looking at what they're doing for their marketing platform. The answer is usually I don't have one, right? And what they should do with their CRM, and literally, you know, then have somebody come in that helps me align with here's where the lead flow goes. Here's a warm lead. Here's a nurture lead. And take it all the way through that process.
Do you have a virtual sales team that you can bring in, or do you end up recruiting specific people for the organizations?
So I do both. I do have a virtual team, and frankly, everybody in my team's pretty senior. They've been around, they've run big businesses. So I bring them in, and it's, you know, I don't want to say freelance, but it's I've cloned the term mercenary sales management. I'll bring the team in and they'll get you to where you need to be. And the idea is eventually you either build and hire a full-time perm team that's, you know, not 1099 or contract based, or we do a long-term contract and we build scale. I have one right now. We're looking at building an aftermarket sales group for. So I've got two guys that are my regular guys that are awesome. And we're looking at building a virtual sales team for them. It'll be interesting because it'll be about 15 people and we're going to scatter them across the US.
That's really interesting. You know, our group, we do the fractional chief marketing officer process where, you know, companies need a C-level exec, but they don't need them 5 days a week.
Yeah.
So we're able to give them that level of strategic thought and execution without getting into a parasitic relationship with an agency, and also without having to hire a full-time person when they don't need it. I'm seeing more and more of it happening in that sales space. And it seems like even though you're not calling it that, it is that you're doing.
I am really, in many cases, acting as a fractional chief revenue officer, even more than a fractional VP of sales. Yeah.
It's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah. Do you in your experience, do you see that as becoming more and more prevalent, more accepted, or is it still, you know, banging your head on the wall trying to convince someone that's what they need?
So there's always the conversation, I want to own your soul. If you're not only working for me, then you don't care about my business, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, I'm pretty direct. Here's the conversation. You want to hire me full time. I keep these parts of my business and this is my price. Oh my God, I can't pay that. Exactly. And you're going to get the same result you get from me and quarter time or, you know, whatever. And I try not to go over quarter time with any single client or project. It ebbs and flows at times, but right. And part of it is they have to realize you're still driving the number. Mm-hmm. And they also have to realize that if you don't build a corporate bureaucracy around it, don't go to meetings for meetings' sakes, right? I don't need to hold your hand. I can read your CRM output. I only want to talk about the deals that move the needle. Don't talk to me about transactional stuff. Every CRO is probably like that. Mm-hmm. I just don't spend the other, you know, 30 hours a week doing 40 hours a week doing other stuff.
So you don't wake up in the morning just hoping some sales guy will just spend an hour with you telling you war stories?
You know, I like those. What I don't like is when I wake up in the morning and the first message is from a client. It's like, you know how I said this deal is going to come in? Well, I didn't do what you said. And now that it's, you know, you talk about buying journeys earlier, we talked about no decision is the biggest competitor out there.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And again, typically when the sales process doesn't allow for enough upfront research, probing questions, and understanding, that becomes more prevalent at the end.
Yeah.
You know, I joke about the guys all the time, the closers, I'm a closer. And I go, you know, in a really, really good salesperson's close should sound like, when would you like that delivered?
Yeah.
That's a close. Yeah. I've done my homework. I understood your need. I've given you a presentation that truly speaks to how we solve your need within the economic arena that was agreed upon. Come on, sign it. Let me deliver it. It's simple as that. If you don't sign this today, you know, the prices are going up on Tuesday, and all those weird, there was a book years ago, like 100 Ways to Close.
Yeah.
I remember there was the Mont Blanc close. That's when you pull out the very expensive pen and go sign your life away. And if I ever did that, it'd be time to retire.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I'll add to that,
something
the greatest salespeople do is they figure out when they're not a fit and they exit the deal. They don't try and turn it into one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's just this week, was having a conversation with a potential client, and after recognizing what they were and what they really wanted to do, we exited before we proposed.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they were upset because they reached out to us thinking we were the right fit. It would not have been a project that we would have been successful with. And those aren't the people who we choose to work with.
Yeah.
So we'll walk away.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a shotgun wedding.
Yeah.
Shoot me. I'm not marrying her.
Shoot me, because it's not going to end well either way.
Yeah. I'll take the bullet now rather than...
Yeah, make it quick.
So tell me, is there anything I should have asked you about working with founders that I didn't?
You know, the one thing that we didn't talk about that is a founder's kind of dilemma almost is they get in their own echo chamber,
uh-huh.
Right? And one of the things you have to do is pull them out of it, right? And so doesn't matter if you're... Great Aunt Jane thinks it's fantastic, or your three college roommates thinks it's the best thing ever, right? You've got to get them out of the people that love them and mean well and will support them, and get them out into reality. That's really the one. If a founder is listening and wants to do something different, that's the thing.
So the you can't smell your own stink dilemma.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yep. There's a key to that, and I talk about it every day. It's usually one of the things that I repeat and repeat until I can't believe I'm still saying it again. You are not your customer.
Yeah.
No matter how much you think you are, you're not. And
no.
And as long as you believe that you're the customer and the data points are related to you, I tell the story a bunch of times. I was involved in a chemical company that was making a no fragrance product that goes into parts washers. And they had, it'd been in the market for a while, and someone had said that they were at a plant, and one of the people said, this stuff kind of has a light, like a swampy smell to it. It wasn't even a complaint.
Yeah.
They pulled everyone from the office into a room, pulled out a table, got a box of all of these fragrances, and they're passing around these little slips of paper for everybody to pick a fragrance, whatever. And it was like 2 hours of zero productivity time to solve a problem that wasn't a problem, using the people in the office to make a decision that if it was a problem, they're the last people you would want to ask. Do you want to do a focus group with your people or the folks who are using parts washers?
Yeah.
Every single part of it was wrong, in my opinion. And that was the moment that I realized that those weren't people that I needed to be working with, because when I shared that, I was being negative.
Right.
So you know, it very similar. You have to recognize when someone else can smell your stink and believe them and look into it. They're not always right.
Right.
But you have to address it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a great point, right? Sometimes you get the brilliant feedback. Sometimes when you do the homework, it's just noise.
Yeah. There've been times where I've gotten some great criticism from folks, some great feedback that really made me better. And there were other times where I was getting feedback to make a change where it didn't matter, because that was what we needed to do.
Yeah.
It was, you know, and that's part of being, you know, the leader is you have to listen to all of it. That's one of the things that I learned too. And from that book we were talking about before, what got you here won't get you there. If you're in that mindset where somebody brings up something in brainstorming that really is wrong, let them know you're going to take it into consideration. You don't have to shoot them down.
Yeah.
That's dumb. That's right. Don't bring that crap up again. That's not leadership.
No.
It's let's include that and we'll evaluate it. And if everyone else thinks that it's wrong, it's never going to rise to the top of the conversation. At least you hope. Although every once in a while, when we do graphic work, I'll have my graphic designer come up with something ridiculous as an alternative, because we need to give three items, and we have two that we really like, and we didn't come up with a third that we really like because we really like those. So we'll put in one that's just kind of ridiculous or silly. I can't tell you how many times that's the one the client wanted to pick.
Is it because it's so different, do you think?
No, I couldn't tell you why, but we'll have two strategic, brilliant graphic images that work, and one that's, kind of like cheesy and out of date. And many times that's the one that they pick, and then we have to kind of back. So we've stopped doing that because it's blown up in my face, thinking that I'm being clever to, drive them towards what I know. And then they pick. I wish I had some examples to show you, because it's been a long time since we've done that. But it's downright funny sometimes when it happens.
It is amazing what resonates in places sometimes.
Yeah. But again, do you design your graphic imagery around the strategy that you're doing that addresses your market and pleases the people you're selling to? Or because you're a huge fan of NASCAR, do you make everything like race cars, even though none of your customers like NASCAR?
Yeah.
So, well, cool. Yeah. This has been, as always, Tim, I love yammering back and forth with you, whether we're recording it or not. There's so much positive in being able to direct a founder with a great idea from a hobby or an idea into an actual thriving business. And it's great to talk to someone who's moved the needle so many times and been successful in doing that. I think the audience really appreciates what you brought forward today.
Thank you. I always enjoy talking about it and always enjoy catching up with you. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, it's fun. So those of you listening on your treadmill or while you're in your hot tub or wherever it is you're listening to your podcasts, or in your office doing work not working because you're listening to me, we appreciate you coming out and listening. We hope that you become a subscriber. And if you click right down below, you'll see the subscribe button. Click on it so you can get past episodes, future episodes, get alerts of what's going forward. And also tell a friend, send a fax to an old person, let them know what a podcast is and that they should be listening to this one. And we will see you all on the next FangledCast. Thanks so much for listening today.
Brought to you by Fangled Technologies, where we help you convert every person your company touches into a voracious advocate for your brand.